I'm Catherine. I'm an alcoholic. It's great to be here. I want to thank Tom and Al for inviting me up and helping me get here. Actually, I'm the substitute speaker because Mary M. was supposed to come up and she was sick. So I was told by my sponsor early on not to say no to an AA request. And what that ended up meaning is that I got to come and stand behind a podium once in a while, which was scary in the beginning, really scary in the beginning. But today it's not quite so much so. And, you know, I feel really at home in a lot of clubs, you know, so it's nice to be here. My story isn't hugely dramatic, but you know, I grew up with a mom who was single off and on. She was a serial marrier, so we had lots of stepfathers and lots of changes, lots and lots. I went to 5 different junior high schools. And that's a short period of time. And it's kind of funny, I tried to learn Spanish, and I realized that I didn't know English very well. The you know, English, the structure of language and stuff, verbs and nouns and things like that. And I realized that a lot of the things that I would go to one school and they'd have covered it, and the next school was, it was just all mixed up, so I kind of kept missing some things. So there's some gaps that I kind of realized in adulthood that I was missing. My mother, I don't know that she's an alcoholic, but I, you know, we've had, in our home, we were exposed to that growing up, off and on. And my sister and I were the two, and my mother, we were the components that kind of remained together and moved through our life. And, my sister seemed to deal with it in maybe better ways than I did. I was the one that sort of acted out and got in trouble. And, you know, I have the personality that if, you know, I push things, and I always cross the line, you know, and I always try to get away with stuff. I mean, that was my big game in life, was how much I could get away with. And I always got caught because I'd always take it one step too far. And, but, you know, that's how I managed my, you know, my uncomfortableness in that growing up phase of my life. I discovered, well, actually, my first experience when I was about 16 in high school. I grew up in the 60s in Santa Barbara, and back then that was really kind of an exciting place to grow up. In the 60s, the Beatles had happened, and there were all the, you know, acid rock groups, and Earl Warren, the Showgrounds, used to have concerts, and so all these big bands that were big in San Francisco and huge and heard on the radio would be playing in San Francisco, and then they'd come to Santa Barbara on their way down to LA, and so we had some amazing concerts, and we had, we demonstrated against the war in Vietnam, and I mean, it was just, you know, it was kind of an exciting time to grow up, and you know, alcohol and drugs were plentiful. And cheap, and I didn't have a ton of money growing up, but you know, people were always willing to share, and so when I was 16, I was very much into that part of the culture. I wasn't that interested in school. At one point, I got thrown into juvenile hall for being out of control, and I was there for about a month, and went into a foster family for a while, and I kind of burned them out, too. And so I ultimately went back to my mother and stayed there through the rest of my high school years. You know, when I picked up a drink, I never had an off button. I just never had an off button. I always drank until I passed out, and that was what I did. I heard this really fabulous speaker once at the Santa Barbara Convention, this guy named Jack G out of LA, and he described his first taste of alcohol in the most profound way I've ever heard it expressed. He said his first drink felt like a warm hug from God. Yeah, a warm hug from God, you know, and I could relate to that. And by the way, if you're sitting in this room wondering if you're an alcoholic, and I'm sure there are a few people that maybe are wondering if you can relate to that. My husband's a normie, and when he was at the speaker's meeting with me, and I said to him, I said, does it feel like a warm hug from God when you take a drink? And he said, no. So if it felt like a warm hug from God when you take a drink, you may be in the right place, and I hope you feel that you are. So I started drinking as much as I could, and plus some recreational stuff, and I was getting in trouble. You know, as I said, I ended up in juvenile hall for a while, and the people that I was involved with were getting in trouble. The guy that I was considered my boyfriend at that time, ultimately, this is kind of interesting, ended up being convicted of murder. He had gone back to Chicago. And he, last I heard, was in Joliet Penitentiary, which is a pretty hardcore penitentiary. And this is a guy I was dating and seeing at the time. And he seemed like a perfectly nice guy to me, you know. But you know, that shows you what I had going on. I ended up meeting my husband, my first husband. I've been married twice. My first husband, when I was 17, I was just starting my senior year of high school, and he just graduated from UCSB, and so he was like the older man, and he was kind of square, you know. He wasn't the kind of guy that I normally would go out with, but he lived in the same apartment complex, and my sister started going down and visiting he and his roommate because they had a guitar and they let her play guitar. And then I found out they had pot, so I followed her down, whatever. And I started hanging out with these guys, and we started doing things together. And where my friends were just sitting around in a living room, passing a bong and sharing Red Mountain. Is it Red Mountain or Mountain Red? Red Mountain, right? The big old, yeah, Red Mountain. God, it's been that long. I hate to say it. Well, I'm getting old. So that was kind of our entertainment. If we had a bag of potato chips, that was it. But he was taking me out to some really nice places to eat. And he'd order wine, and he'd always order me a glass. And because he looked older, they never questioned my ID. And I guess I looked a little bit older, too. And I started, really kind of liking the lifestyle. I actually know the moment that I fell in love with him. We were kind of two left. Everybody had gone out on New Year's Eve, and the two of us were back at his place. And I went across to the liquor store and bought some Courvoisier brandy, which is like really good stuff. And it was love. It really was, you know. I was in love. And he, you know, he used to have this big coffee table. And what he did, he would he'd have a jug of wine, and he'd have all these chips and dips and cheese and crackers. And I mean, I really like all that kind of stuff and the wine. And then he put on whatever was on TV in the way of sports. And we watched football, we watched baseball, we watched Bowling for Dollars, we watched, Wide World of Sports. And you know what? I learned to really like all that stuff, because I really didn't like sports before that, but you know, you give me a bottle of wine and all kinds of goodies, I'll sit and I'll watch anything, you know? I was really happy. And In fact, oh God, tomorrow's the Super Bowl, I really love football. Football is my thing, and one of my I have two favorite teams, and one of them's in the Super Bowl tomorrow. And if I think about it too much, I can honestly almost not be able to breathe because I'm so excited. So that's kind of how our story began, and we ended up getting married. And we moved up to Ojai. I had my first daughter, and actually this is significant. I got pregnant about 5 months after we got married, and she wasn't really planned, but I could not stop drinking, and I knew I was pregnant for the first 3 months. It was about 3 months. I found out I was pregnant, I still couldn't stop drinking, and I drank every night till I passed out. And this is before we really knew about fetal alcohol syndrome. But I was worried enough to talk to my obstetrician, and I said that, well, you know, I have a glass of wine at night, you know. And he goes, have two, you know. Well, I didn't tell him how big they were, you know. and you know, it was just, I was really scared that I was going to, but it seemed so unreal that there was something growing inside of me. But alcohol, I had never been able to stop after the first drink, you know. I really couldn't, and just being pregnant wasn't a reason that, you know, I didn't feel that compelled. Well, I felt like I wanted to stop, but I just couldn't. And something happened at about 3 months in my third, at the end of my third trimester. I was suddenly the taste of alcohol didn't taste good anymore, and I found myself not wanting to drink. And I mean, that was huge. It was a miracle, and it was nothing that I had you know orchestrated. It just didn't taste good anymore, and so I stopped drinking, you know, except for an occasional screwdriver or Bloody Mary or something, you know. But drinking every night till I passed out was no longer going on, and so I ended up having this little baby, and you know, one of the other things that was going on with me at that time too. I also had an eating disorder, so I was practicing that during the day, and I was drinking every night until I passed out. So at my lowest weight, I was 95 pounds, you know, that's not compatible with long life, you know, the kind of lifestyle I was living. But I gained enough weight after I got married to become pregnant and then have this little baby. And we moved to Ojai, and a few years later, I had another daughter. And the same thing happened. I would just drink every night till I passed out. And then when I was pregnant with her, again, I couldn't stop drinking when I was pregnant. But some again, right around the little after the third month, I stopped. And they were both born okay. Actually, both of my daughters had conditions that later on I found out. It's funny, I ended up going into nursing, and I'm an OB nurse. I work with moms and newborns. And I found out that both of my daughters had some situations that could have been caused by my drinking. One of them had severe strabismus, which is where the eye goes out. It was really severe. She had to have a surgical correction. They sometimes see that in with alcoholic mothers. My other daughter had a leg, a hip thing going on, and sometimes that particular deal is seen in alcoholic mothers. So. Neither one of them were impaired, as you know. I mean, they're functioning, highly functioning adults. So their brains, thank God, were not damaged. But you know, it's a really sad thing to me that you know that was their start in life. You know, and that they had a mom who was impaired. And what ended up happening, you know, my drinking continued. Once I was breastfeeding, I was still drinking, and I crossed a lot of lines. I'd drawn a lot of lines in the sand as far as you know what an alcoholic was. You know, if it ever gets that bad, I'll quit. When you know, and I'll put a line in the sand and then cross it. You know, I had a lot of those. I'd heard that an alcoholic was someone who can't stop after the first drink. And I'd never been able to stop after the first drink, so I kind of threw that definition out the window. The second definition, one of the definitions was that an alcoholic is someone who has to drink in the morning. And as long as I had the other eating thing going on, I never felt like I needed to drink in the morning. I had that was my thing that got me through the day. And then at night I could drink once my husband came home. I woke up one morning and I had a one-year-old and a five-year-old, and I woke up needing to drink as desperately as I've ever needed anything in my life, and it felt like I had the beast on my chest staring me in the eye, and I was terrified. I was really terrified. I knew if I started drinking at that hour, I would be non-functioning within a couple of hours. My one-year-old had just learned to walk, and I knew that, you know, I couldn't keep up with her. My five-year-old was going to be coming home from kindergarten, and I wouldn't be able to pick her up. I mean, it was just in my face. And I ended up, you know, they do a really smart thing in Ventura County. I was living in Ojai at the time, and we had the paper. And they put an ad for Alcoholics Anonymous in the want ads. And I mean, isn't that brilliant? I always wanted something. So I was like always reading the want ads to see what, you know, what do I want now? And so I knew that they had a number for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had remembered that. And, you know, I ended up just being scared enough that day to pick up the phone and call for help. I was 26 years old. I didn't think I was old enough to be an alcoholic, but you know, I kind of needed somebody to tell me that because I was really scared. And I ended up getting patched through to a lady named Annie, and Annie was took that phone call and talked with me on the phone probably for an hour, and I just told her my story. I told her I was frightened. I had two little kids. I couldn't stop drinking when I started. And I asked her if she thought I was an alcoholic. And we're not supposed to say, yeah, I think you're an alcoholic. But she said, you know, you probably have a problem. And, you know, and she invited me to come with her to a meeting. And she lived down in the Ventura area, which was probably about maybe 16 miles away from where I was. And she said, there's a meeting in Ojai. And at that time, this is in 1976, there were only three meetings a week in Ojai. And we didn't have our Alano Club up there yet. We had a Monday night speakers meeting, and it was Monday, and then there were two other meetings. There was one on Wednesday and one on Friday, and that's all we had. But it turned out the day I called, they had a Monday night speakers meeting, and she said, "I'll meet you there," and so I said I'd be there, and I just hung on by my fingernails through that day, and I was shaking, and I felt horrible. And my husband, he was bringing home a new van. I'll never forget it. He was bringing home a new van that night, and he was late because he had stuff. You know, he was doing this transaction, and he came rolling up, and I grabbed the keys from him. And this car I'd never driven before, and it was a huge car. And and I said, "I'm going to an AA meeting," and I mean, he, you know, watch the kids. And I ended up sitting in the back row of this AA meeting, and there was a lady who'd come over from Santa Barbara, and she was dressed in this really nice suit, and she had her hair up, and she had pearls, and I was like, she's an alcoholic, you know? It's like, she didn't look like what I thought an alcoholic looked like. I thought, you know, y'all, you know, went out in the parking lot on the break and drank, you know? I mean, I really didn't know what happened here. But, you know, I remember reading Dear Anne and Dear Abby, and they always said Alcoholics Anonymous was the place to go if you have a problem with drinking. And I thought, well, you know, so there I was. And the rooms back then were very smoky. Everybody smoked. And but this lady told her story. And you know what? I listened to her story. And I was kind of mortified for her, too, because she was, you know, she'd tell all these stories on herself. And everybody laughed. And I'd be, like, embarrassed for her. You know, I thought it was just horrifying. But I could also relate to a lot of her story. I could relate to, you know, not all the things that she had done, but certainly I had done enough to really relate to what she was talking about. And at the end of the meeting, they passed the basket, and Annie's sitting next to me, and she said, "Don't put anything in the basket, you're a newcomer." And so the basket went by, and at the end of the meeting, we held hands and said the Lord's Prayer, I think, at that time. And they took me up to the literature table and filled my pockets with a bunch of literature and gave me phone numbers, and everybody was really nice. And then she said, "Would you like to go and get something, you know, a cup of coffee after the meeting?" And so I said, "Yes, I'll go with you." And so we went over to, it was, I guess it was Caro's back then in Ojai, and we sat at a table, and she said, "The way this works is you get a sponsor." And I thought a sponsor was somebody who paid for you. You know, she told me not to put any money in the basket. So based on that, I asked her to be my sponsor. So it's so funny, you know, I think about, you know, that moment of asking for help, you know, picking up the phone and being terrified and not knowing what it was gonna bring. And by the end of the day, having, you know, my first meeting under my belt, a pocket full of phone numbers, a sponsor. And this was somebody she was just coming up on her sixth AA birthday. And this woman had a very solid foundation in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was so blessed to have her start me off. She said, what we do is we go to meetings and work the steps, and she walked me through the steps. And one, you know, and the thing about Alcoholics Anonymous that's always impressed me is that, you know, I've had a lot of people telling me what to do in my life and telling me why what I'm doing isn't right. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, we show you what we're doing, and it's a whole different deal. It's one alcoholic talking to another, and it's truly magic. You know, it's truly magic. I mean, when people who've been there and have seen, you know, the beast and looked him in the eye, and have been taken to places they don't want to go because of alcoholism and not been able to stop, there's only another person that's had that same experience that can really, really, you know, relate. And so I'll always be grateful for Annie. One of the other people, we had an amazing group of people back in those days. And I can't come up here and not think about Meg. Do some of you guys know Meg? Yeah, Meg was in Ventura County then, and she was huge in my life. She and Glenn and her sister Sally, I mean, these were the people that I came in with and adored. I mean, she was just, you know, a great person. And I've been really mushy today, so it's not just this. It's just been that kind of day. But I got to go to her funeral, and I got to see probably some of you guys there. And one of the things that really impressed me was the size of that church. I don't know who all might have been there, but it's a big church where we said goodbye to Meg. And along the back row, there were all these guys that looked like really heavy-duty kind of Harley guys, you know, standing. Oh, thank you. Standing there, and you're standing like this, you know. And, I mean, they were there, you know, to say, you know, it was just so beautiful. And people, you know, talked from their hearts about what she meant to them. And she was a great lady. But, you know, I was so blessed to have people like that in my life when I first came in. And they were such fabulous examples of this program. And they made me want, you know, they said, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, they made me want it. And you know what? They were having fun. I honestly thought when I walked in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous that the fun was over forever. And I was just terrified enough where that was even okay with me. I mean, honest to God, it was okay with me. And so I came in willing. You know, if you're new, I sincerely pray that you have that kind of desperation, because that's the desperation that it takes to really do the stuff that it takes to stay here. You know, people say that, you know, it's not for those who need it, it's for those who want it. I say it's for those who work for it. You know, if you're willing to work for it, it's you know, anybody can have it. But I really believe it takes that degree of desperation to really do what it takes to stay, and I hope that you have that. So I started on my journey. It's kind of a long story, so I'll try to be, you know, not too overly wordy. But I had my two daughters. My first husband, who is my drinking partner, God bless him. He still drinks, and he's a good guy. But I just couldn't be married to him, you know. After a point, we were together 3.5 years into my sobriety, and I needed to let that go. And it was hard. It was hard for him, my daughters, for me, for all of us. And then I began my journey for the next 10 years as a single mom. And I put myself through nursing school, and you know, I couldn't have done it without his help, you know, with the girls. I really couldn't have. And you know, during that time, I'd kind of gotten a resentment in AA. They still smoke like crazy. I'm not a smoker. You know, I got really busy with my life. I was working, I was going to school, I was in the hospital, I was trying to do things with my kids, and I had a boyfriend who wasn't doing, you know, who was a drinker. And who was kind of a bad guy. And what happened was I stopped going to meetings, the classic thing, making everything else more important. And you know, I found in my life today, if I make anything more important in my life than my recovery, it's subject to loss. And I ended up finding that out. It took a long time for that to happen. I was 7 years sober, 2 years without a meeting. The relationship I was in had gotten violent. It was, you know, he was drinking and occasionally using, I don't know what all, but But one day it got bad enough, and what was available was pot. And in my mind, in my thinking, I thought, well, you know, it's not alcohol. So since it's not alcohol, if I ever go back to AA, I just won't tell them about the pot, you know. Like, I don't need to know about that. And so I ended up smoking pot for about 6 months, and the relationship continued to get worse and worse. I don't know what made me, I guess we ran out. I don't know what it was, but, you know, when I didn't have pot for a couple of weeks and the relationship continued to get awful, and I mean, I just woke up one morning and it was, and I was in a really terrifying place. The relationship I had, as I said, was violent and it was frightening. And I ended up coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, and I was coming up on an 8-year birthday. And I hadn't been to a meeting long enough where I thought, you know, don't you hate it when people come and you never see them, they show up to take a cake, and everybody sings happy birthday, and they don't know their name, so they go, happy birthday, dear. And I wanted everybody to know my name, and so I started going back to meetings. It was so awful. I started going back to meetings. It was just, I don't know, I'm such a scammer. But anyway, so I started going to meetings, and I didn't want to share that I had gone out on pot, but so I didn't identify as a newcomer. But the thing I had gotten from my first, because I had some solid recovery the first time, I'll tell you, I had good people around me, and they were working good programs, and I knew what it took to get sober. I knew I needed to go to meetings, I knew I needed to get a sponsor, and I knew I needed to start working those steps. And so I started working the steps. Got a sponsor, a little kick-ass sponsor from L.A. named Georgia, and oh my God, she was great. Just, I mean, tough as nails and wonderful. And I needed somebody with a lot of strength because I felt really weak at that time. I had to get a restraining order, and I was really shaky and really a mess. My life was a disaster. And I hung on to Georgia, and she had faith, and I had lost mine. And she said, you know, honey, faith is like a muscle. You know, if you stop using it, it atrophies, and so you have to start building it again. It's like going to the gym. You got to start building. You got to work it out. And when you first start working on that faith, she said, it doesn't feel very comfortable, but you just keep working on it. And you know, I just had faith that she had faith in the beginning. That's all I could come up with. But I just followed her around, and I was working the steps, and I ended up writing my first inventory, which was a total mess. Well, this is the second in this phase of my recovery. And I wrote this inventory, and it was a totally BS inventory on one level, because it was all about blaming him for why my life was so horrible rather than taking any kind of responsibility for it. And I came home after doing my fifth step with her, not telling her that I had pot. And what I was taught to do is when you write an inventory, you get the big book down and you review what you've done. And I brought my big book because I love my big book. I got this in 1976. It's a second edition big book. And it's all underlined and all the different colors. I can kind of tell you where I was in my life by the color of the underlines. And because I don't want to, you know, just kind of paraphrase this, I want to tell you what I read and how it affected me. And I want you to listen to the promises. And this is from the chapter 6. It's Into Action on page 75. And listen to all the promises in this. It's incredible. We pocket our pride and go to it. And this is talking about our fifth step. Illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Once we've taken this step, withholding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we are on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. I mean, are those beautiful promises? I mean, that's from the fifth step. That's what comes when we do the work here. It's fabulous. This is the part that nailed me right between the eyes. Returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we have done. We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know him better. Taking this book down from our shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first 5 proposals, we ask if we have omitted anything. Duh. kind of busted on that one. And it says something so beautiful. It says, "For we are building an archway through which we will walk a free man. Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement put into the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand?" Well, I burst into tears, you know. I think I went for the ice cream. You know, it was just, you know. I mean, it was just so in my face, you know, I needed to come clean. You know, I needed to let go of, you know, the ego that you know, of the, you know, the 8 years that had slipped away, the 7 years that had slipped away. And I needed to start over, you know, and it was hard on my ego, but, you know, it was so fabulous. One of the things that not having continuous sobriety has given, well, a couple things. It's given me compassion for those who slip. You know, before I thought, how could anybody, once you find this, how could it not work for you? It's just so great. And then I had that experience, you know, and I understood that. You know, I understood how cunning, baffling, powerful, and patient this disease is, you know. I'll tell you one thing, if you're sitting in this room, it has your name and it has your number, and it wants you dead. And that's a fact, it wants you dead. So I let people know that, you know, I was starting over again, and, you know, and it's been a fabulous, fabulous journey. Let's see, how much time do I have? I am an RN. I worked many years in a hospital setting, and today I have this kind of cool dream job. You know, I love working with moms and newborns, but the hospital just wore me out. After 18 years of 12-hour night shifts, I just hit a wall. I couldn't do it anymore. And today I get to, we have a program called WEB. You guys have it up here too. It's called Welcome Every Baby, and I get to go into the homes. I have the privilege of going into the homes and visiting moms and their newborns, and doing the nursing visits, you know. And I saw a two-day-old yesterday. You know, it's just a thrill, and I get to spend lots of time. I don't have to rush. It's no beeper in my pocket and cell phone. I'm not like running all over the place, and it's really cool. I'm married for the second time. My husband is a normie. He's the guy that I ask questions. I say, you know, I'll ask him, Steph, do you ever have drunk dreams? Because, I mean, I don't know, you know. And he says, no, you know, he doesn't, you know. And he does not understand the phenomenon of craving. I mean, that is something that is unique to this disease, you know, drinking dreams. And one of the things I tell people, if you have a thought of drinking, if you're new, if you have a dream about drinking, or if you're old, I mean, sometimes people can feel very ashamed of, you know, having some time and, oh my God, I had a drinking dream. You know, I thought I was working a better program. You know, honestly, those can happen to any of us once we've crossed that line. I heard somebody once say that you can never, once you've crossed the line, you can never, you know, turn back into a cucumber. Once you've been a cucumber, you can never, once you turn into a pickle, you can't be a cucumber again, you know. And so we've got that, you know, if we've had enough alcohol in our systems, you know, that happens. And so, you know, if you have a drinking dream, if you have a thought of drinking, share it right away with someone. You know, it loses its power. It's magic to just share it in a group with another person, pick up the phone, call the AA hotline. I had a drinking dream. Who cares? They, you know, just let somebody know, you know. Don't keep it inside. It's when we keep those secrets inside that it just kills us. It just absolutely kills us. So I'm married to a really nice guy today. And I'll tell you, we've had some adventures. We're coming up on our 16th wedding anniversary. He's never seen me drink. When we married, he was very successful at what he was doing. And his job ended rather suddenly. And so he started a company, and then he started a second company. And it was a very exciting time. I mean, we started off our marriage as, you know, property owners. We owned a home and two condos, and we were kind of living the American dream. And then what ended up happening is that my husband's businesses did not do well. We had a number of things happen. We had big dreams. The dreams fell flat, and we watched literally over the course of about 10 years, we lost two homes and two condos. And it's hard. I mean, it's really hard to be at this time of life, you know, and, you know, towards the middle years and have finances not exactly where they should be at this point in our lives. But I can tell you this, what was the constant in whatever ups and downs, we've always just adored each other, you know? And we didn't have to throw each other away when things got hard. And I'm really grateful for that. We do this cute thing, Saturday night surprise date night. We take turns planning dates, and it was my turn to plan, and I told him he could come here if he wanted to, and he decided, he's already heard me, so he was okay with waiting and doing it another night. But you know, we have a really lovely relationship, you know, and we have respect for each other, and our kids love us and respect us. Well, actually, I have one daughter right now. Both my daughters are very successful. They both have their own businesses and really successful. One of them's like written up in magazines and has been on television. I mean, it's really, you know, fabulous, the success she's having. But you know, she grew up with an alcoholic mom in recovery, a dad who never found recovery. She has issues with her childhood, and I, you know, I lost something precious of hers that she had created, and I don't even know exactly how it happened. We've moved a few times, things have changed, it's been a lot of chaos, but it triggered a whole thing for her, and now she has to find her way with that, you know, and I have to allow her that. And it's really hard because right now she doesn't want to have a relationship with me, and that's really sad. It's really hard, but you know, it's all part of her growth, and I love her. And so what I do for her, because she doesn't want to have contact right now, I say prayers. I don't ask God so much for stuff anymore. You know, I didn't know how to pray when I first got here because I thought you just ask for stuff. I thought that's what prayer was. And God was kind of Santa Claus. And today what I do is I thank God for putting his arms around the people who, you know, are walking through difficult things, and she certainly is. And I just, every morning I'm on my knees, and part of my prayer is I just put my arms around her and send her a hug, and I feel it. You know, I feel this warm glow that I'm sending her. And whether or not she ever feels that, it doesn't even matter. I feel it, you know, and I'm doing it. And I just thank God for carrying her right now. So, you know, life isn't perfect, but, you know, I love this program. We moved back to Santa Barbara after living in Ojai and then Camarillo for a number of years. And what is so wonderful is to walk into a brand new fellowship. And I walked in, and I remember leaving the house the first morning. We'd moved that weekend, and here was Monday morning, and I'm off to find you guys. And I left the house. I thought, you know, I don't know anybody in Santa Barbara anymore, but that's going to change in 5 minutes, you know? It was like, I just so believe in this program and the safety net that you guys offer me, you know, anywhere in the world. I've only been in one place in the world. I was in Africa. I was in Abidjan, which is the capital of the Ivory Coast, and there are no meetings in that part of the world. But everywhere else I've traveled, I've done some traveling. It's just wonderful to call up and find you. In fact, I was in Sweden. This is hilarious. I was in Sweden. My husband had business over there. We've just gotten off the plane. I've taken a nap. We're meeting his business partner and his wife. I'm meeting them for the first time, and we're sitting across the table from them, and I'm looking at my watch, and I said, you know, I really have to go. and he said, where are you going? I said, I'm meeting some people, you know, because I'd lined up those meetings. You know, the cool thing was international directories, they give you phone numbers. You can make contact before you ever leave the States, and they meet you there. So I hop in a cab, and I tell them where I want to go, and he says, okay, do you want me to come pick you up after? So I said, nah, I'll get a ride. You know, be like, I'm in the country 5 minutes, and I got, you know, it's hilarious. So all I need to do is get there, and I know I got a ride back, you know. It's just the most amazing, amazing thing to have this kind of love and support wherever we go. Today, there's a gal who's moving from England. She's landed in Santa Barbara. She's setting up a home here. And I was telling her that one of the meeting that we go to Saturday morning was just relocated for the one time up on the Mesa. And she didn't know where that was. I'll pick you up. And you know, it's like, that's what we do. You know, we just do that. And once you've had the experience of being that out of towner, once you've had that experience of being that newcomer, you know how much it means to have that hand extended, you know. And that's one of the responsibilities I feel today. I feel like that was done so graciously for me, so time after time after time. And it's just such a lovely thing to be able to give back. If I did a 12-step call every single day of my life, it couldn't pay back what's been given to me. You know, I'm so grateful for this life. And again, thank you. It's just wonderful to be here in your wonderful Olano Club and see those steps and those traditions on the wall and the slogans and your beautiful faces. And it's just a pleasure to be here. And I wish you all continued recovery and keep working at it.